Welcome back to the TV Talk Machine. I am your co-host, Jason Snell. Across the internet from me, your genial host, the chief TV critic at The Hollywood Reporter, Mr. Tim Goodman. Hi, Tim.
Hi, genial. That could be a first.
I'm going to roll in new adjectives for you from time to time.
I like it.
Just because. See?
I like it.
See how
are you doing?
I'm doing good. Watched a lot of TV this week, actually. How about you?
Oh, yeah. That's
every week for you.
That's a thing.
That's
yeah.
Life. Yes, that's life. That's life. It's good. It's November now. So traditionally, this is when everything gets crazy and stunty and weird on TV because of sweeps. Do sweeps matter anymore? Is that a thing anymore?
Not really a thing anymore.
All right.
No. I mean, they still happen, but they're more for local than they are for national.
All right.
To set their ad rates. But nationally, everybody's doing their own thing. In fact, in November, it kind of winds down, and then we'll go into all the holiday stuff and get a little bit of a break.
So I always the place where I still notice that it sweeps, period, is those local TV news promos where in the yes. middle you'll be watching a network TV show, and in the middle it'll be like, is the lead in the supermarket murdering people at 11? And you're like, oh, I guess it's that time. We have an in-depth investigative report that just happens to be out in November because...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Always rats in the kitchen. Rats in the kitchen at your mm-hmm. favorite restaurant. Mm-hmm. News at 11.
Lead-covered yeah. rats.
Lead-covered rats.
Are
yes.
in... Yeah. Are spreading typhoid through
yes.
your local burrito establishment.
Yep. Yes.
At 11. We a lot of stuff going on though. You wrote some provocative things this week.
I did a little bit. That's a good word for this week. Yes.
All right. Yeah, I should have used that as your provocative host. Mr. Tim Goodman, the age of denial. I loved this story that you wrote at The Hollywood Reporter. Great headline too. Your show is dead, or the age of denial on broadcast TV. And as I was reading it, I was thinking of the conversations we've had about this. And Minority Report was a good example where, you know, after the first week, you're like, yeah, it's gone. It's dead.
Yeah,
and yet there's this denial that happens. It's like, well, we're cutting back the episode order and all this stuff. And maybe with Live Plus 7, it'll be. And your point is, no, don't why stop lying to yourself. Don't lie to yourself like you are your own Montel Williams.
Right. What it was. It was a whole Montel Williams moment there, no doubt. They're still lying to themselves.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was it was fun to write that. I say fun in kind of a twisted way, kind of a wake-up call, but it's a story that's been going on for a really long time, and it just, you know, we're all kind of aware of it, and Jason, and I've been writing about industry stuff for a really long time, and this is, along with sort of the peak TV thing, this is a response to peak TV. This is with a big issue for broadcast networks, and writing a lot about failure analysis as I do, mm-hmm. It's kind of interesting and a news angle for me when I see nothing happening, like when I see no movement at all, and you know, movement is slow, so it's like if you were going to make an impact in 2015, you really had to retool things back in like 2012. And become leaner, and et cetera. And so one of my colleagues at The Hollywood Reporter on the TV team, Leslie Goldberg, did a thing. She wrote a story, which the headline was How Trimmed Became the New Cancel, and it was all these shows trimming orders, just like you said, and not killing it when we all know they are dead. And so I took that and sort of extrapolated it. And I didn't want to just say, hey, look, broadcast people, your industry is dead. Wake up, you know, or it's dying and your shows are dead and you have all these problems. I try to address some, you know, a little bit. I try to get into some of the reasons why that is and how they could fix it. But this is such an enormously complex thing that one column is not going to be enough. And I couldn't do everything in this one. First of all, it'd be a TLDR situation. Mm-hmm. And I wanted people to get through it and read it and have some ideas at the end of it. But like, this is just the beginning, and I'm sure I'll revisit this in my ongoing failure analysis columns in the future.
Well, one of the things that you mentioned that I thought was really interesting is this. It's almost like a conundrum. I mean, not even talking about the contracts, because who knows, maybe part of it may be that they can only trim and they can't, you know, it's not like they can say, Well, I guess they could say pull the plug right now, but they may have been committed to a certain amount of episodes. Anyway, who knows about that part of it? But to leave them running and just like a black hole in their schedule is one of the points you brought up. And I wonder if they're trapped or if they just feel like they're trapped, that like the only way broadcast can do a show is you got to put all your money into it and all your marketing into it, and it'll either be a hit or a miss. And what you say is the other way to do this is to hedge your bets, not overspend on like super expensive shows, so that if one of them dies, you can just say next soldier up and slide something in there. But the situation you portray here is almost like if one of these big shows just dies outright, either DOA or I liked DOSE, dead on second episode, that was really good. It's like they got caught with their pants down. They're like, what do we do now? Instead of being able to be like, we're ready, we know some of these things are going to die and we're going to put something else in there. And then their schedules just bleed for weeks afterward, which doesn't make any sense at all.
No, it doesn't make any sense. And if you look at the sort of that very logic, if the networks were, they don't really know what to do, and they are kind of caught. They're kind of caught between bases here. They're years behind the curve on this. But if networks were just doing what they've done historically, they would have canceled Minority Report and
pulled it off the schedule immediately.
Yeah, and got it off the schedule and then put something else on. But the reason that they're not doing that is they don't have anything else.
Yeah.
And that is a sign. That's a sign that there is a money issue that is at play here. Everybody would have, 20 shows, and they would just keep throwing the spaghetti at the wall, see what sticks. But that's how it used to be for ages. So they're kind of acknowledging it, but by not developing as many shows, and trying to stick with things longer. Which cable does, right?
I mean, you don't.
Which cable
does? Cable doesn't pull a show if it tanks in the ratings after 3 weeks. They run their 13 episodes or whatever, and then they move on.
Right. But there's this one indication. I look at it like, how much do network people know about how dire their actual model is and what they can do to do it? And you know what? You run into this problem, Jason, when I was writing this, is that no one has sort of said, okay, we are going to change. And I think if they all changed together, or if they all took over the idea of changing at once, it would work. But no one is like, everybody just thinks it's going to be somebody else's problem. And then next year it comes along and they still have the same job. And they're like, well, I guess it's my problem again. And it's this self-fulfilling prophecy. You have two major problems that I see. First of all, the networks still think that they're broadcasters, and they're really not. They are infrequently broadcasters when they have, CBS is still pretty much a broadcaster. They still are winning, hands down in the total ratings. They don't always win in the sellable demo, the key demo, but I'm sure they will probably this year because there's not much competition. But they see themselves outside of shows, these rare Roman candle shows.
Like Empire.
They one of those goes off and they think, well, that's what we do and we just need to get more hits like that. But they're not acknowledging the fact that that is such an outlier show that their real business is they're in the cable business. They're in a narrow casting environment because that's what the last 5 or 6 years, certainly the last 4 seasons of the ratings have told them. And it just it's getting exponentially worse. And the reason it's getting worse is because we're in peak TV. We're in too much TV. Everybody has all these choices. No one has any loyalty to broadcast networks anymore. They don't care. They just want it to be a good show, and they'll watch it anywhere. They'll watch it on Nat Geo, for God's sake, if it's scripted. They'll go there. So, and you and I have talked about this. They'll watch something on WGN if they can find it. It's about the show. It's not about the network. So, but the first thing that has to change, and I don't look for this happening, because when you get that outlier show like Empire, or when you look over at when they look over at their sister channel or a competitor in CBS and think, well, how are they getting 20 million and 18 million and 17 million and 19 million? I mean, how are they doing it? Well, that is a totally different thing that's happening over there, and they've just done it right, and the other four are not doing it quite as right. They're making decent shows, but they just need to realize they're no longer broadcasters. And that's a real hard thing. It's like an identity switch, and it's behavior modification, Jason, that they can't bring themselves to admit. Because if once they admit that they're that most of their shows are going to get, you know, 3 or 4 million audience, and maybe if they're lucky, a 2.0 in the key demos, or you know, something along those lines, that are much reduced from history. Once they realize that they come to the realization, which I think they're going to have to soon, that they're basically narrowcasters and they're basically cable channels, then they have to say, okay, well, we're not built for that, because we're built to put 22 hours of television on, you know, a week, and we need to have all these shows, and we have to have a midseason and a summer season, and they're going to go insane. So I don't have that answer. If I had that answer, I wouldn't be in this job. I would be, you know, selling myself to fix them. You know, but they think about, and I made the analogy in there that it's kind of like the auto industry. You kind of have to, for a number of reasons, I could have kept that auto analogy going, but imagine like if you're ABC and you have so much failures, or you're Fox, you have all these failures, only one thing took off, and you're not making any money, and you're thinking, oh, how the hell are we going to not make all these bombs? You just have to rethink it somehow. You either have to not make as many shows and admit that you're not basically going to program 22 hours, and I don't know what the answer is there, or if you stay in that model, which I think that they will. That's my assumption, that they can't. It's going to take 5 or 6, 7, 8, maybe a decade before they say, okay, we're not this anymore. We're a niche channel. So today it's not going to happen. So if they're going to reimagine who they are and what they do, the best way to succeed in this current marketplace is to make cheaper shows like cable does, and make more of them, and probably less length of the run, probably, you know, 13 episodes or you know, maximum probably 13 episodes, sometimes somewhere in that cable era. You just got to make them cheaper. And part of the problem that I didn't get into in the story, Jason, I know we're going to have a link to it, but one of the things I didn't get into is, if you're going to make cheaper shows and if you're going to try to survive, everything has to change. It's like how you cast it, how much you pay for people, how you do the pilot process, and then the script process, paying for scripts, paying for pilots. All that's going to be completely done in different ways. And unfortunately, all five of the networks do everything the same way. Everybody follows basically the same schedule. So you start thinking about the enormity of the situation, and there's no wonder that there is no change.
Well, the whole broadcast thing in the U.S., the fact that the U.S. is so big geographically, and I know other parts of the world this is different. You know, there are the idea of broadcast television, which used to be television, and now it's almost like this weird thing that, you know, you can get it if you're in certain places geographically over the air, and they, you know, and they're programming. But you're right, they're programming 22 hours a week of primetime programming. And the rules, I mean, it's just a really weird thing where it's a very specific block of time that belongs to them nationwide, that they're responsible for programming. And, you know, we've seen networks advocate it too, like the whole Jay Leno thing on NBC. That was them essentially saying, we're not going to program 22 hours.
Right.
We're going to give away 5 hours to a talk show, which is super cheap. And even that idea totally crashed and burned. So I don't know. It's weird. It's like once the networks are cable and not networks, not broadcasting anymore, I'm not sure whether the economics of the whole thing really hold up, which is pretty scary for them.
Well, I think the whole industry right now is looking at the economics of the whole thing, because, and that's why this makes, you know, this is just one, you know, it's a pretty, thorough column, I think, but as far as the covering the whole idea, there's just not enough room to do it in one column, because, I mean, you're talking about, there's sociological elements here, there's economic elements, there's, you know, there's so much that's into it. I mean, most of these, you know, all of them actually own their own studios. So if you're going to own your own studio and make shows and churn them out, then you are not a cable channel. You are a big, big thing. You know, cable channels do have their studios. They do make their own stuff. But these guys are making shows. Like Fox is making shows for everybody. And that's just – I mean, you can maybe work the economics of that somehow. I'm sure there's a smart bean counter somewhere who's working that out. But at some point, like if the system's not working and you have to scale back, that's one of the things that's going to have to go. And so – you know, you're not going to do your own studios. So yeah, it's really hard to say, okay, how do we fill 22 hours but yet make it economically viable? How do we keep people coming back to us because we have product on the shelf rather than, you know, if we scaled back to 15 hours a week, maybe people go, oh, well, they're going to tank. They're going under, so we're not going to watch them anymore. Our loyalties will shift elsewhere. So there's a lot that goes into it. It's kind of frightening to think of the enormity of the problem to make it work. But right now, I think that there are fixes, and the one that I propose I think is the easiest one because it fits in the economic model, but it fits in the just how the business is run, just the nuts and bolts of their production. Which means mass amounts of shows rather than, you know, HBO does movies and they do some miniseries and they do series. But if you look at what they have on their shelf and what FX has on their shelves or AMC, and then you compare that to ABC and Fox, I mean, it's no contest. There's the broadcast networks are churning out way more stuff, but they just need to keep doing that. They just need to make it cheaper. And that's the only thing that I can see, that will help them out. And then that, to make more shows, to make shorter runs, and to make them cheaper, and that's doable. But that's a big problem unto itself. But it's doable, and they can do that in the next couple of years.
Don't they risk being? I mean, at some point, don't they risk being seen as having worse content, cheaper content than cable if they don't already?
Well, I think that's a great question. So I wonder if that's really a going concern for most viewers because. Mm. You know, I look at something like, I'm watching Man in the High Castle now on Amazon. And I look at that and I think, okay, I mean, the production stuff looks really good. It looks like they put money into it. Yeah. Then you kind of notice it. But, like, I think if you give people an interesting show, a good show, they're not going to talk about what it looks like. They're just going to be entertained by it. For example, you know, people love sitcoms, and sitcoms are all the money in sitcom is in the talent, in the writing, and whatever. It's not so much in the set. You've got one set, you just keep turning around. It's on your lot,
right?
So your money's going to, you know, either people who are below the line. You're looking at high priced actors, and you're looking at, you know, what you're paying the the writers and the executive producers. That's where your money is. But unless you're looking at something where you get Mad Men and you think, oh, that's so beautiful. They've got everything perfect. I think most people are just going to say, hey, I'll take Battlestar Galactica, the remake, which was, you know, not expensive, didn't have a very big set. And, you know, it's just the lack of money forced them to be better storytellers. And that's what you need to do. Because if you look at TV right now, all these expensive flops, it's just – it's broken. They've got to fix it. And I don't think that people say, oh, yeah, people are not going to remember Minority Report, Jason, and say, well, yeah, it didn't work, but boy, it looked beautiful. No one's going to ever remember that. But it either worked or it didn't.
Yeah.
It either worked or it didn't.
There's one other point I wanted to mention. You talk about denial that I just wanted to throw in there because it's interesting. It's, in today's day of complicated ratings, where there are just not just the overnights and not just the weekly ratings, but there are Live Plus 3, you know, DVR, Live Plus 7, Live Plus 30. Mm-hmm. You mentioned this, and your point is dead is dead. And we've mentioned this before on the show that, like, there are rare exceptions, but generally the shows that do best when you add in the DVR ratings are the shows that do well. It's not
right.
It's very rarely that there are some aberrations, but not a lot. Like The Walking Dead, when you add in the DVR, is still The Walking Dead. It is that much better. But what it does add is this like ability to hedge and deny the death of your thing and be like, well, let's wait for the Live Plus 30. That's not, there's no logic to that, right? It's just allows everybody to kind of put off the decision in the hope that there'll be some sort of magic number that comes out.
And to that very idea, I think that there are shows that fall into this gray area where you could say, and you know, this is not all black and white. So it falls into a gray area where you think, oh yeah, okay, I could maybe see how this is a decision you need to think about that's not so obvious. And for example, Scream Queens on Fox came out, did not do well at all, did better in the Live Plus 3, went up significantly. So they can point to that number and say, oh, it had a 53% boost on the after the third day. And then on the seventh day, it went up as well. But what you and I are saying is that, okay, but overall, the number you're getting overall is still not great. It's, you know, it's going up, but it's like a corpse that has a little hiccup. You know, it's just, and but when you get a decent enough number in those plus threes, plus sevens, even a plus 30, then that's when they start to think like, okay, this is doable because it's not what we want it to be. It's not, you know, like the, one of the freshman hits right now is Blind Spot, and Quantico does well too. So it's not those, but it's also not Minority Report. It's better. But and then you start to fit a couple other factors. One, Fox spent so much money on advertising Scream Queens. And so all that money that they put into it is sunk cost, but they wasted a lot of money because that show no liftoff on Scream Queens. On the other hand, it did a little bit better on those three and Live Plus 3 and 7. And then you have the relationship with Ryan Murphy where you say, okay, Ryan, we're not going to just – you don't want to just cancel a show that Ryan Murphy makes because you don't want to piss him off because you're in business with him. You want to stay in business with him. And along the lines of an anthology like Scream Queens, they can say, okay, second season, what will you do different to improve it? And we didn't have to invest in so many episodes. So in something that's smaller, I think they have a legitimate, you know, period of being in the gray area, like, should we renew this or not? Is it dead? Can we make something of it? But if it's a set series like Mulaney, when we can always joke about that in the Mulaney line, or in this case, the current stuff like Minority Report and Blood and Oil, those shows are dead. I think that it's a much easier decision on those. You're like, okay, that shouldn't be there. So it's really the ones you want to build for 22 episodes or 24 episodes in the network world. When those tank, you know it. If it's something smaller and maybe it has an auteur director or creator behind it, then you maybe think, look a little deeper at those extended numbers.
We should move on and talk about a couple other things that are going on.
Yes, it's not like this one's going to go
leave
away.
Leave the graveyard for the moment.
Yeah, we'll have many times, many issues to come back and talk about what ails the TV industry and specifically the broadcast industry.
It's not going anywhere. This subject will continue. We talked about Agent X a bit last. You went into great gleeful detail about Agent X last week, and I added it to my season pass list, and it premieres Sunday. As we record this, it's coming up in a couple of days. So we just want to, one, remind people that it's coming. Two, your review is online now at The Hollywood Reporter, and you've promised a drinking game in some form. So
yes, and I'm going to have that out. I'm hoping to have the drinking game posted by Sunday before it airs. And by all means, I think people should watch this show. We laughed about it gleefully last week. But this is that rare show that I said, like I said, it's so bad you should watch it. It's one of those rare ones.
So what has happened? Something Agent X related has happened in the last week, I hear.
Yes, it's really kind of fascinating. So the guy who created it and wrote it, William Blake Heron, you know, he's done other stuff. You know, he wrote one of the Bourne movies, and he's a producer. He's actually done a lot of varied stuff. So he listened to our podcast last week.
It's great when the showrunner for Jane the Virgin listens to us praise her show and say, yay, it's another thing. So how'd that go? Did he contact you, or did you just sense a disturbance in the forest?
No, he did contact me, and I want to read it because he's a very good sport. And I'll read this. This is his letter. He said, hey, your podcast reviewing my show popped up on my compulsive Google searches. As you might imagine, I think you missed the point of our escapist series. Mm. That said, you were really, really, really funny, like Mystery Science Theater funny. So I have to begrudgingly give you your props. All the more so since I've enjoyed seeing other programs similarly roasted by critics in the past. As we know, Schadenfreude is the drug of choice in Hollywood. Only fair that it's my turn now. I look forward to your drinking game, and I hope that it leads to you watching more AX and perhaps seeing other more flattering virtues as the season evolves. All the best, William Blake Heron.
Well, that's very nice.
What a champ, right?
Yeah.
And so he actually started following me on Twitter before this, apparently. And so now he's seen how terrible the review was. And before the review came out, the actual agent, played by Jeff Hefner, started following me, and I was like, "Oh God, And this is a separate story we could get into, but it is kind of funny when you notice people following you, and I don't know if the network tells them to, or they just get a hint that your review is coming out. I get a lot of people following me before the actual review comes out. Like if it comes out, like, obviously Aziz Ansari is not going to follow me, but like he had word that I really loved Master of None, which drops tonight today. You could see like somebody saying, well, I'll follow Tim now because I know he loves this show. But following it beforehand, that's very risky. I will say this, though. So Jeff Hefner, who followed me and is actually the agent.
He is Agent X. Yes. He's following TV Talk Machine, too.
Yeah. Is he really? Oh, yeah. I love it. He apparently listened to it, too. And he sent me an email that said,
oh my God.
So I guess in some way they get it. I gave him props too because I was like, dude, it's big of him to sort of do that. And he sent me an email because he wanted to add something to the drinking game. he said I should definitely put in there when he touches his ear and talks back to Gerald McRaney and that it works all the time, no matter where he is, where he is in the world, or what a bunker he's in, or what the distance. It's basically just a cell connection, but of course, he just touches his ear and he has instant clear cut communication. So I think I'm going to put when Agent X touches his ear and connects with Alfred, as I say, that part of the drinking game. But props to those guys for going along with it. It clearly was not a good review, but. And I had said that TNT didn't get out in front of the fact that this could have been a spoof and they should have played it as comedy rather than drama. But these guys are getting out in front of it because, look, I'm not the only one. Tons of reviews have come out and they're bad. But I like the fact that these guys did that. And even before I knew that, I had said in my review, I'm going to watch this show. I'm not kidding you. Because, look, 24 became so much fun. 24 was a lot more high-minded at the beginning, but 24 is basically Agent X. They did a lot of crazy stuff with Chloe and the subnet and the dark web and all that. So
yeah, not to mention Mountain Lion.
Yeah, Mountain Lion. And look, Homeland got to be crazy too. So whenever you do spies and things, you get to the point where you're kind of crazy. Homeland still thinks it's Emmy material, but at some point, 24 kind of got over that, and I think that they might have been wink-winking at us too. I mean, obviously. Kiefer Sutherland was joking that like he carried enough stuff in his little side satchel to like bring down the world. So I think there should be shows where you watch it and they're entertaining and fun. And I think that's what this, William Heron said is it's escapist. So have fun.
Well, I'm glad they have a sense of humor about it. I think that when they talk about escapist, I mean, they intend for it to be fun and maybe not have the reaction be it's so bad it's funny, but they're intending it to be kind of not realistic and ridiculous and all that. And hey, I love that they have that's very nice that they have that attitude of rolling with it and not just becoming angry and, threatening your life at the next time they see you, which has happened in the past.
It has happened, yes. I told them that they were both great sports,
yeah,
about it, and I think you have to be at some point. But here's the twist in all this. I mean, in some way, their show's so bad, I don't want them on the air. It drives me crazy that they even got made. This show is just fun.
Yeah.
It's kind of fun in a bad way. And maybe not, like you said, maybe not as bad as they wanted it to be. They didn't want it to be reviewed like I reviewed it. But I still think I want, I hope they get renewed. I would love that cable thing where they renew the second season before the first. I want to see the announcement today that Agent X is in for two seasons because it's fun. And I'm going to TiVo this thing. And I'm gonna watch it, and I'm gonna have a drinking game, and I'm gonna have a lot of fun watching it.
That's great. We should mention another show that we've talked about before because you reviewed it a long time ago, but it's now available for streaming, which is Master of None with Aziz Ansari
mm-hmm.
on Netflix.
It's so great, and you should watch it tonight. My caveat is, and I think other people's, we were the first person to review it. We just jumped on the, because we're a trade, we're always kind of out early, but we went right up maybe an hour after the embargo ended. So we were probably the first review that went out there. And, others have followed and had similar things to say about that. The first episode isn't the best episode of the 10, and I watched 5, but it's good. It's a good first episode, but to get a real sense of the series, just keep watching, because from 2 onward, it's really great. And it's got almost universal, I think maybe even universal rave reviews. It's done a bang up job. He's getting a crazy, crazy enthusiastic critical praise, and I'm happy to see it, because it is another show to watch, but it's a great comedy, and you can see it develop. I think that, you're going to be able to see Aziz Ansari take his character and broaden it, which is what he does, and goes in all these different directions that you don't normally see on TV. And it's just a little show that could. It's just it's a very different take. It's not super glossy. It feels very real. Feels very authentic. It feels very, I hate to say this word, but it feels very organic. Like, let's make a show. And let's not make it super glossy. And I just want to backtrack real quick when we talk about networks. And, how to make a show cheaper. I don't know what Master of None costs. It doesn't look super expensive. It's shot on location in New York. It doesn't look super expensive. There are no famous actors in it, except for Ansari. A couple of the actors are also like writers on other shows, so they're not the greatest actors, but they come across as real. So... that's kind of what if you could make, what if Fox put on Master of None and got that kind of critical acclaim? That might drive people to watch it. I'm not saying it's going to be Empire, but maybe you would have a comedy that got great critical acclaim and people watched it and it did well. But even if they didn't, Jason, you could make it for – it doesn't look like it costs that much money. It certainly doesn't look like it costs as much as whatever – all the other stuff they got on there. There's no high gloss on this show.
Right. All right. People should check it out.
Yep.
Netflix.
Starting now.
So much stuff. Jessica Jones is coming soon too.
Yes. And I want to tell Daredevil fans that I'm not reviewing Jessica Jones. So you can just relax.
Dan doing that one?
Dan's doing that one. Dan right. Feinberg will review that. And I think that's good. I think it's I think it's probably good to, although I'm a believer that I should be able to look at anything that comes across the screen and just say, okay, what is this? Is it any good? I think it's good that somebody is reviewing it who actually knows who Jessica Jones is.
Yeah, it's okay. I mean, again, you want to judge the show as a show, but that's why Dan is there, is that
he knows the history.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, he knows the history. I think he's going to do a great job.
I'll report in for the podcast listeners about it. I'll tell you what I can corroborate whatever Dan says on Hollywood Reporter. The Expanse, by the way, Sci-Fi is doing a streaming preview of the first episode. I don't know if you saw that.
I did not.
A few weeks in advance of, I think it's coming in a couple of weeks, they're going to put the first episode online on all the streaming services in advance of the premiere in December. So that's kind of a fun idea for the, like, get the fans buzzing about it.
Sure. Especially for a genre series where they need to have buy-in and then they need to have loyalty, which you could get in a genre series.
And they showed it at like New York Comic Con or something like that. I mean, they've showed it before, but now they're going to stream it publicly just in advance. So
cool.
That's nerd talk.
You're going to be all over that. I'm not sure that's on your calendar. I also don't want you to forget in all of this talk, we had wonky talk about life and death at networks and how the business works, but do not forget that you definitely have to watch Agent X.
Oh, yeah. It's season passed. It's set.
Okay. Because
it's happening.
There's so much tech stuff in there.
I literally recorded it, set it to record during the podcast last week.
Okay.
So
that's right.
That's
true. That's right.
I got my TiVo remote out and did it right here.
Doop, doop, doop.
Yep.
Ba-doop, ba-doop. I remember that now because I just wanted to, I cannot wait to, I can't.
I will give you an Agent X tech report next week.
I can't wait for that. And it only gets better. Well, it doesn't all happen in the first episode.
See, this is why they say all publicity is good publicity, because we are like becoming viral marketing for Agent X now.
I think we are. Actually.
This episode of the TV Talk Machine is brought to you by Agent X on TNT. Should we do some letters? I got a lot of letters here.
Let's do that.
All right. First, a tweet from Spiffy. Spiffy says, just for you guys at TVTM, a couple classic cop, not a cop shows. I mentioned that.
Oh, yes.
That was in a letter last week, and I linked in the show notes actually to the Flophouse where they do the little bit about cop, not a cop. Murder, She Wrote, the early seasons, which is true because Tom Bosley was a cop, and of course, Jessica Fletcher, not a cop.
Not a cop. Scarecrow. Also the real killer, in my theory, was her. Okay, but whatever.
Right. Murder, She Caused. Yeah, we were clear on that. Here, it's in the title, Scarecrow and Mrs. King. which is sort of spy, not a spy, but sure. So thank you, Spiffy.
I don't know why this makes me laugh so hard. It is such a great idea, though. Okay,
good. Cop, not a cop. No, that's Spiffy. It's just two suggestions. Send in your cop, not a cop. Kevin on Twitter just wanted to point out that if Lisa Schmeiser of the Flash cast on the Incomparable Network heard our episode last week, she would be furious because we said that that we were referring to Dominic Purcell when we got him confused with Wentworth Miller. It doesn't matter. They're both on Prison Break. They're both on The Flash. But we were talking about Captain Cold, and we gave the name of Heatwave, which is not. You can't do that. That's a major nerd faux pas. So I apologize to both Wentworth Miller and Dominic Purcell for that.
Wow. Yeah. I'm so happy that I'm not involved in that at all, because all of that was Latin to me. That was Latin.
Little fact checking there. We got the actor's name wrong. It's fine.
Okay.
It's all corrected now. This will live forever. Matthew Kennedy, Matt, wrote in and didn't specify an area code. So we'll just say he's in the Hotmail area code.
Okay.
I believe the gimmick that Tim was going to point out, this is follow-up from last week, about The Last Kingdom and forgot, was hiring a big star for the first episode and then immediately killing him off. In this case, Matthew McFadden from Spooks and Ripper Street and a bunch of other stuff. I like to think of this as the Robert Patrick gambit, because they're like three or four shows where Robert Patrick is in the pilot and you're like, oh, he's an authoritative figure. He will probably be one of the leads. Oh, he's dead.
And Sean Bean.
Yeah. Oh, Sean Bean. Yeah, sure.
Classic.
Uh-huh. That's some good stuff. Yeah. You hire somebody because in the pilot, people don't know and you're just paying them for the pilot. You know, you're not signing them up for the whole season, and then you kill them off and you subvert expectations, except everybody does that now.
Everybody does that. But I swear to God, I did not see that coming. In that one, because I was like, oh, Matthew McFadden, I love his work. He's so good in MI6 and / Spooks and all this other stuff. And then it's like, what? They got me. They suckered me in, and they got me.
It happens sometimes.
It does, and they do. And they that happens a lot. It's kind of a nice little twist.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite shows of all time is Buffy, and that in the first episode there we are introduced to the three high school friends who Buffy is going to befriend, and it's Xander and Willow and Jesse. Jesse doesn't make it, guys. Jesse doesn't make it. Eric Balfour, and I always wanted him to come back as like do a time travel episode or a parallel universe episode. And it's like, hey, everybody, it's Jesse. It's like, remember him? He was in the first 30 minutes of the first episode, but nope, never. It's a good trick. You kill, introduce a series regular and immediately kill them.
And I did totally forget what that was. So thankfully
thanks,
pointed
Matt.
That out.
Mm-hmm. All right. Jamie in the 414, which is Milwaukee.
Is it?
Yes.
Okay.
According to Jamie, self-described Milwaukee, first-time emailer, long-time listener, providing the credentials here. How is Peter Hartlob's cousin these days?
Well, it's funny you mention that, because when he said 414, I thought Atlanta, but it where his cousin's from. But that is 404, I believe, is Atlanta.
And Jamie specifies that Milwaukee is one of Question Boy's underrated cities, if memory serves.
Yes, he's a long time listener.
Yeah, this is an OG.
Oh yeah, when you mention Peter Hartlob's cousin, that's a real deal OG person.
I follow Peter Hartlob on Twitter, and he posts lots of great stuff. Still at the Chronicle, posting interesting stuff, and I can't not think of Peter Hartlob's cousin. Just because that was a thing.
Oh yeah, Peter Peter Hartlove's cousin and I are still friends, and I follow her on Instagram. So look, it's still out there.
Look at that. That warms my heart. Yeah. This is what Jamie says. The first couple of episodes of Crazy Ex-Girlfriend have been pretty entertaining, and the musical bits have been a hoot so far. Besides trying to fill 22 episodes with content, my wife and I have what we call the Mindy problem with the show. That's pretty good. I like that. On the Mindy project, Mindy Kaling is supposed to be a super smart, up-and-coming OBGYN, but the character is so unbelievably flighty, it strains the credibility of the show. For as much credibility that a sitcom can have. One minute she's obsessing over Beyonce's shoes, the next she's teaching other doctors at Stanford. Crazy Ex-Girlfriend seems to have the same problem. One minute Rebecca is stalking her summer camp's ex-boyfriend's new hot girlfriend. The next she's solving binding arbitration problems that have been a problem for a decade. Wuck. Another callback. Yes.
Another callback to 30 Rock.
So what Jamie says, are we being too tough on female comedy leads? It's easy to overlook the flaws of Leslie Knope, Liz Lemon, and Selena Myers because Parks, 30 Rock, and Veep are or were such ensembles bigger than their lead characters. I guess Mindy and Rebecca, there's no more ridiculous in their positions as Andy Samberg on Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and I don't have a problem suspending my belief there. Are we being unconsciously misogynist? Is there a television glass ceiling for women as comedy leads? Do TV writers have to make women leads parts of the joke? Look, she's so dumb and a Harvard-trained lawyer. That's hysterical. Sorry to get so deep. And will Dan be the one who reviews future seasons of The Riches? Now that is an old joke with a new context. Bravo, Jamie in the 414.
Wow.
So what do you think? This is an interesting idea. Is this idea, is it an actual issue where you've got these kind of like brilliant characters who then do all these dumb things? Or is that just, that's the roots of comedy and we shouldn't, it shouldn't matter whether it's a man or a woman that's in a comedic lead position like that?
I mean, I don't think it should. I think that those are two good examples where it does happen, and it is a little bit like, why really? But that's also, let's keep in mind that those are also two shows created and written by women.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they were the catalyst for that. So,
well, I think Mindy Kaling, and knowing some things about her from like the books she's written and stuff like that, my wife's a big fan of Mindy Kaling. Mm-hmm. That you know, she contains multitudes, right? She is a professional. She is an actor, writer. She's been very successful at what she does, and she also has this other stuff that interests her. And I think that one of the things that she does in the Mindy project is say, this is all part of me, right? Mm-hmm. I can be all of these things, and that's fine. I don't, you know, just because I'm a professional, whether it's a doctor on TV or what she does in real life, doesn't mean that I have to shut off all these other parts of me. And it doesn't mean that just because I've got it all together here, that I have it all together in all the other aspects of my life too. So I think that is purposeful, but I totally get like having the radar go off on like, wait a second, you know, you know, why is she should be acting smarter here. But I think the Brooklyn Nine-Nine, I think that's a good example where, you know, Andy Samberg, he's a successful cop apparently in Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and yet he's kind of an idiot. So
right. And you know, most of the women on that show are smart and the men are not, which is also kind of funny.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I think it's interesting when women create shows, come up with the ideas and write them. And then we say, oh, the lead character is weak. I think that the containing multitude story is actually, argument is actually good. I think that's true of both of them. And, you know, why I think sometimes when you're klutzy or you're, you know, down in, you know, if you're a little bit into, you know, you can be silly and then serious. I think that it would be bad. Let's put it that way. I think it'd be bad for comedy if we said, okay, women can't act like, you know, she can't be interested in the shoes, or this woman can't be like totally like obsessed with an ex-girlfriend or her boy. You can't limit people like that in the creative world. So I'm okay with it, especially because they created it on their own and they seem to be fine with it.
All right, let's go on to Will in the 919.
Yes, a lot of like 414, 919. I don't even know where the 919 is.
A lot of palindromes, North Carolina.
Okay, I like it. That's a good area code. This runs right off the top. Yeah. 919.
So, started to catch up on Mr. Robot via the USA app on the Apple TV. The show is great. The presentation is painful. An hour and 15 minutes viewing time with the same non-dismissible ads should not be the future of TV. This caused me to wonder about storytelling and presentation, especially if editing techniques for American shows will move toward those employed elsewhere, which do not accommodate in-episode advertising. For comparison, I'm thinking about The Wire, where the story is told as a continuum through tightly narrated natural transitions between scenes versus something like Nikita with its every ad break has a cliffhanger editing. With the TV business model lurching through a massive change that already affects episode and series length, what changes to the visual language do you foresee? Will in the 919. Greg, another brilliant question.
Another brilliant question. We have that, you know, anybody in the advertising world should be saying, we need to market and support this podcast and target those people because they're brilliant.
Brilliant.
Brills. Well, that's a great question. I think that anytime the source material comes from anything that's ad supported, they're going to be in there. I just think that there are, that's just the nature of the business. When you watch Mr. Robot on USA, it's going to have breaks in it. And, you know, the show is written to those breaks. And, you know, it's just to backtrack and make it kind of current, this whole Mindy thing, when the Mindy Project left Fox and it went to Hulu, it was a weird thing. It went from four or five act breaks to three. And, you know, people don't normally in the real world even think about that. But Mindy was like, hey, we got more time to do it, but we have to put our act breaks in a different way. So we have to write the show differently. And structurally, that I found that kind of an interesting, like they were like, yeah, how do we do three acts? It's not standard in TV. So I think if it comes from an ad-supported genre, it's always going to be that way. However, as you know, like if you get Hulu's premiere subscription or whatever, there won't be any commercials in
it. Right.
So then you can watch it just straight through.
Yeah, we got that,
mm-hmm.
And it's pretty great.
Yeah, and obviously the same thing with Netflix when you stream it there.
You know, I can't believe I didn't even mention this. This was the other huge news this week that we didn't even get to, which is that they announced that they're going to do a new Star Trek series, and it's going to be streaming. It's going to be on CBS's CBS All Access platform. That's where you're going to see it in January of 17.
Right.
Which was kind of interesting because it's not like CBS doesn't have places that they could broadcast such a show, but they've decided that they'd rather use it as the first of what they say is a series of scripted shows that they're going to do just for CBS All Access. So that's CBS saying, yeah, we've got a network, but we're also going to do Netflix. We're going to be our own Netflix or Hulu. Which, I mean, they're sort of already their own Hulu because they put their own shows on CBS All Access. But now they're going to do original programming, too. So that's a new wrinkle, too.
It is. I don't know if it's going to work.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's going to work. I don't. You know, they are drawing people to Supergirl currently. They don't have a very strong genre audience anyway. But they're getting in. You know, it's holding up. But, like, would you... I mean, if it's HBO or Netflix or somebody who announces that, you're like, sure, because with my subscription to your All Access, I get all this other stuff. Well, you don't get anything else that you're not already getting for free on broadcast.
Right. Yeah. I think that's the question is if this is all there is, then they're basically saying, yes, for $6 a month, you can pay to watch Star Trek with commercials. Or $10 a month, you can pay to watch, you know, those four episodes of Star Trek without, which is essentially like, you know, buying the episodes on iTunes or something like that. It's not a particularly good deal.
That didn't strike me as.
Well, I mean, there are people who pay for HBO just for Game of Thrones, but there are lots of other people who they pay for HBO because they get Game of Thrones and John Oliver and Veep, and, you know, just the list goes on, right? And what else is in that bundle for CBS? It's a little bit different than what Netflix offers, where there's another show around the corner. So I'm a little skeptical about it too. That if it makes sense if they're committed to building that out to be like a Netflix or Hulu or HBO where they've got a bunch of original stuff, but are they?
Yeah. How long will it take? I mean, if you buy into this, I mean, you can cancel obviously after you see the shows, but like how often would you, I don't know. I saw so many flaws in that idea. The only thing that I saw as a positive step was like, okay, I looked at it like, okay, we're tipping our toe in this,
right?
You know, over the top. We're going to do that. And so we're going to go over the top and we're going to do our own streaming service and let's try it with this show. So I thought, okay, that's good. I would not buy it. Certainly, because nothing else, rarely anything else I want to watch on CBS that I'm not already getting for free.
Right. And I was struck by how it reminded me of, is it Powers? That's the show that was on the PlayStation Network. And that was based on a comic by a comic book writer I like a lot. And I haven't seen it. And that's because I'm PlayStation Network. Like, I'm not going to sign. I have a PS3. I suppose I could sign up for their service and watch those episodes on my PlayStation. But that's not going to happen, right? I'm not going to sign up for their service just to watch this one show. I've already got a bunch of other services. So that's part of my skepticism. I'm a big Star Trek fan, so I probably am one of those suckers who will do it. But if I were them, I would plan. I would embrace it, and I would go wall to wall. Like, I would commission other things that are kind of Star Trek or, Star Trek related, and have those ready to premiere around it. I would try to build up like enough stuff around it that it made it like really feel like I was getting my money's worth. Do a Talking Dead style analysis show afterward, and have a behind the scenes documentary about every episode and whatever else, do some, I don't know what else you do there, but if it's literally just a 42 minute show once a week on a stream on CBS All Access, I don't, that's weird.
Well, it also in a abstract way goes back to how we started the podcast by talking about networks trying to retrofit themselves on the fly. And it's like, if you were to sit down and think of this idea, just like you just talked about right there, literally that, in an ideal world, you would not launch that service until you had created enough content. You would say, okay, here's where the trends are going in television. We can see them. We're not all dummies. We can see them. So, hey, let's start a unit that does original content for this thing that we're going to launch in 2 years. Let's ramp everything up. And then when it comes out, we'll say, hey, do you want to pay $6 a month for these five shows and these documentaries and these, Talking Dead top stuff? Yes, I probably would. But it's another example of the network saying, okay, this is a thing over here, the streaming thing I hear about. Let's throw a rock at that.
Yeah,
that's what I see.
Although being CBS, I feel like they're kind of from a position of strength, being like, we can do everything, we can do anything, we don't even care, we don't need Star Trek on one of our existing networks, we can use it to launch this other thing.
I know,
Who knows? Maybe there are other announcements between now and then where they say, well, Star Trek will be coming on in January of 17, but in March of 17, there's going to be a Flash Arrow spinoff that's also going to run, 10 episodes, and that's going to be on there too, and there's going to be this other thing, and enough that people are like, oh, I see it now. I see what they're kind of trying to program. But
yeah,
well, they got a year. They got 14 months to figure it out, I guess. But
a lot can happen then.
Yeah, but it's interesting. And it goes back to the interesting question about storytelling that, the storytelling has already changed, not just in commercial breaks, but with the ability to binge shows, right? Where shows are not being built even with a narrative that goes per episode anymore. And it'll be dropping tomorrow, the next episode of The Incomparable, we talk about the Star Trek show in detail. And that's one of the points that comes up is you can't tell stories like Star Trek has historically told stories, where there's a standalone, we go to a planet and we meet some strange aliens and we learn something and then we leave at the end, because TV isn't like that anymore. I mean, there are still even serious procedural kind of stuff has way more in terms of ongoing storyline than ever was really the case with most of the Star Trek series. So I think that's going to be interesting to see too, is when they make it, are they going to change the storytelling to fit the fact that they, that modern audiences want more serialization in their stories. I don't know. It'd be interesting to see. That little digression, a little Star Trek digression.
No, that was good. We'll take it.
Les Moonves, he's a madman. He's doing whatever he's doing. Sam in the 707.
Oh, yeah. We know where that is.
Yeah, that's
wine country.
That's the wine area code. Thank you guys for working so hard to hit the one-year mark, even if it was 52 non-consecutive international releases. I'm hoping in year two has more Putin and Bill Walton appearances. It seems unlikely, but I'm not going to do my terrible Bill Walton anymore. I've met Bill Walton. I'm not going to do any more Bill Walton appearances. Although every time I see Bill Walton on TV, I send you a tweet. I'm like, yes. Bill Walton is at the Giants game right now.
It's like, don't.
Walton notion. I was thinking about what you guys said about shows we should have opted out by now. Gotham officially lost me in a scene where a bad guy went to get arson supplies. He went to a Costco-esque warehouse with machetes, bomb supplies, and a lady announcing specials over the intercom system. Delete. Cancel season pass.
I love that. I like that. That's an opt-in for me. Yeah.
I feel bad for Donald Logue, serial picker of good roles and bad TV shows. As for Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., I will admit to being a Marvel cult member and giving it much longer of a rope if ABC rolled out some generic-looking supercop plane show. Supercop? Not a supercop. The show had gotten much more interesting lately. It has a lot of room to improve. I agree with that. Speaking of Marvel, I couldn't help notice last week a show I'm very excited about was mentioned only to be kind of brushed off by Tim. Jessica Jones, what are you hearing about it? Are you hearing anything about that, by the way? I've heard good things.
Just the trailer. Yeah, people loved the trailer.
Yeah.
But I have a hard time modulating what is buzz, because in my feed, everybody's like Nerdville.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, right. 5 seconds of a Star Trek trailer and now it's the best thing that's ever been in the whole wide world. So I have a hard time modulating what to expect.
I resemble that remark. So thanks, Sam. Let's see, get through a few more of these. Scott said, you asked what shows we're still watching even though we should give them up. Mine is The Last Man on Earth. I switched off last week's episode, I think it's 2 weeks now, when it became clear the show would return to its less desirable format of one character lies to everyone and when they get caught only commits to the lie harder until they're totally unlikable. I've been inspired by your conversation and I'm pruning that show out of my rotation. It pains me to know that there's 30-minute comedy starring Kristen Schaal and Mel Rodriguez and I'm not watching it because it's not that good. But then again, I guess these are times of confusion.
Times of confusion.
Thanks, Scott.
Tough cuts.
Yeah, that was good.
I'm with him on that. I can't watch that show.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Here's one from Ian. Also not specifying. Please specify your
area code, people. You should know by now.
All right.
Area codes.
Yeah, but this is a good letter. Hello again, gentlemen. Okay. My wife and I are near the end of season one of Gotham. Somewhat ironically, it's because of press there. It has been on about how dreadful it is. You guys may even have been the tipping point where we decided that we had to see for ourselves. We had to see how bad it is, but we have carried on. I think Ian may be from across the pond. But
I was just thinking that. I think we've heard Ian from, he's from England.
Yeah,
I think.
From the plus four. We've carried on through the first season. We have a theory as to why two discerning adults such as ourselves are still watching. Utter tosh. There it is. We had such low expectations by the time we watched it, we were able to relax and enjoy it to the point where I can look past one of the personally speaking most annoying things in TV. This is great. I work in the firearms industry. This means I'm more than aware pretty much all the gun stuff on TV is not a thing. How many times can you actually cock the hammer on a firearm in a TV series? A lot, apparently, if it's set in Gotham. The Foley guy seems to love the sound of hammers being cocked, even on guns without hammers. How does a modern 6-hour P226 semi-automatic pistol make the same sound when being cocked as an old-school Smith & Wesson Model 10 revolver? Lazy Foley is how. And no self-respecting cop will walk up to someone with his gun out and then cock the hammer. Absolutely not a thing, even in a city where it's acceptable for a cop to cock a double action gun to make it single action as they're using it to hold up a suspect. My point being that not only am I a gun nerd, I am a gun nerd that's walked away from movies for less, and yet I'm still enjoying this clunky and ultimately pointless show. I just hope I haven't pointed out something you're going to notice in every TV series featuring guns. I think you did. Which, by the way, do not make the metal sounding snick noise when coming out of a holster that TV seems to think we need to hear to understand that someone has drawn a firearm. Definitely not a thing. Ian. Thank you, Ian, for ruining all firearms on TV for all of us.
Never watch
forever.
A gun thing again. Yeah, it's going to be like, you know what's great, though? I think we should have not a thing experts in different fields.
That would be great. Yeah, write in about your favorite thing that you know is not a thing because you're an expert in it. I would love
to
hear
that. I would love that.
Because I can do that with the computery stuff, but I don't know anything about firearms, so we had to have Ian come in and ruin that. Eventually, we will have ruined every trope that's in TV. So,
absolutely.
That's how
but
it should
now,
be.
Ian ruined the whole gun thing.
Yep.
And this is the United States of America. Guns go off on our TV a lot.
What I'm saying is I hope the Agent X people are listening to Ian.
We shoot a lot of shit in this country.
We do. Check the box.
So He's ruined everything.
Yep. Thanks, Ian. Thanks, England, for ruining our firearms.
Thanks, England. You and your gun laws.
All right. Brian, from the still in the 209. That's my area code of origin. The 209 up in the that's your Stockton, Modesto, and Foothills area.
Yeah. Okay.
Gentlemen, I just received an email informing the Esquire Network will soon, beginning November 14th, premiere its first original scripted series, something called Spotless, or The Spotless. Thank you. Thank you, Brian. This time, the times they are changing, and by that mean they're getting more confusing. What I'm really writing is this. We have a terrific wine bar over here in the 209 where the resident sommelier every Saturday afternoon conducts a sommelier boot camp. For a modest charge, you can spend a couple hours getting insights into how professional wine nerds analyze, evaluate, and more importantly, drink wine. Whether or not one actually sharpens one's ability to break down the bouquet of a wine or tweak out its subtleties on the tongue, it's a very pleasant way to spend an afternoon. You drink some nice wine you might not otherwise have encountered, and you may actually learn something. Here's what I'm leading to. What would TV critic boot camp look like? In 2 hours on a Saturday afternoon, what would Tim do with a small group of enthusiastic but unschooled TV fans who had gathered to have their critical eye on TV sharpened? By the way, I'm sure that wine would also be an integral part of this experience. What do you think? Brian, still in the 209. Yeah, so what would you, if you had, I mean, you sort of do this with your class, you know, how do you get somebody, what do they look for? What should they look for when they're watching TV?
Well, yeah, for my class, which we do over 15 weeks, and we do it actually here on the podcast as well. We do talk about process and format on shows. I think that, look, it's funny. I teach a visual studies class, and television is a writer's medium, but there are visual things that are, once you get into really good shows, that people can look at and learn from. I look at, like, when I'm reviewing a series, the things that drive me crazy are, for example, I'll just make an example of this. I didn't review, but I watched Flesh and Bone, which is about to come out on Stars. So your premium cable channel, high expectations of total quality. Moira Wally Beckett, who was a writer on Breaking Bad, super respected. Everybody wanted her to get a show because she's amazingly talented. She gets a show, and she made Flesh and Bone about the ballet world. And the first thing I think when I see a ballet show is, okay, this better be completely different. Especially if you're or any kind of genre thing, it has to be a little bit different. But no, it was really bad, kind of shockingly so. And part of the reason that I didn't like it, and maybe I liked it, maybe I got angry at it because I expected more from her, but they didn't change any of the tropes. It was basically Black Swan all over again with a, you know, even less desirable twist at the end. But you know, you had to have the guy who was the former ballet master who now runs the thing. And he's, of course, he's satanic and he demands everything out of these people and he crushes them and I own you and all this. It's all cliches. So that's one of the first things I look for. You know, are you subverting the genre? Are you doing something new that I haven't seen before? So those are some things you can do and how's the acting? How's the storytelling? Do you have a premise that is sustainable? That's something you would in the 2 hour fake class I'm teaching. Do you have a, you know, is there more here? Like I would look at Quantico and say, are people really going to want to watch 22 episodes of this when you will not get the answer this year? I don't think so. I mean, that's, to me, I would bail out of it. So those are some things. And visually, one, I tell my students just, and this is going nowhere. I mean, but you can take this and at home and look at it. But visually, the first thing I tell people is that you need to go from passive watching, which is with the history of television. You sit on your couch and you just, it's okay, entertain me.
Let it wash over you. Yeah,
let it wash over me. And then you need to know what's going on. Mm. You need to know how things get framed, how they look, et cetera, et cetera. But one of the basic things I always tell people, and we don't have time to get into it, so draw your own conclusions when you do it, is just watch a show and ask yourself, where is the camera and why is it there? And that takes you from passive to your active thing, because then it starts. You start noticing things that you take for granted, like cuts. So then you can look at a scene and say, "Wow, that scene took 1 minute for me to show it, but now as I looked at the camera work, I realized it maybe took them a day to film it because there were so many cuts. They were outside, and you know those kind of things. You learn more about how the actual camera works and the director of photography, what he's doing. But yeah, it's very simple. Where is the camera and why do you think it's there? And, you know, why is it you know, why is it shooting them from above or below or from this kind of, why is it hiding behind things? What is that trying to, what are they trying to tell me visually with it that they're not actually telling me, but they're, I'm supposed to process in my brain. So things like that. That's what I would do.
Do you have a laptop or a notepad or something that you are jotting things on constantly while you're watching it? Do you take notes throughout and do you pause it?
I take notes by hand. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's funny because Alan Sepinwall and I talked about this once, or maybe over the internet we talked about it. I can't remember. We were both watching Mad Men the same way, where we would watch it one time without notes. Watch it just to enjoy it, no stopping it, and then watching it to take detailed notes because both of us were writing, you know, obviously recaps and deconstructions or whatnot. These days I take notes, but I try not to stop it if I can, because that I want it just to unfurl and show me what you right. got the first time. And you know, ultimately, I hate to say it, but ultimately I take way more, I'm sure everybody else does too. I take way more notes than I ever use. I write down so much dialogue and sure. I never really put it in there.
Yeah. Okay. We got a couple more here. Min in the +47, that would be Norway. I looked it up. See, wow. International release to Norway. We're covered.
Norway.
We got you, Norway.
Yes. Uh-huh.
We got you. We got your Lily Hammers.
Nice.
Min says, when I was growing up in the late 20th century in the 801, we would get reviews delivered to our house on a weekly basis. Without the internet, there were not many choices of critics to read. Over time, we learned our family had significantly different tastes from the primary local critic, Sean P. Means, so we would often take his most vehement negative reviews as excellent indicators that we were going to love a film or a show. I'm just going to say two words, Mick LaSalle. Anyway, a couple of questions. When writing a review of a show you didn't like, do you consider readers who may disagree with your taste? Do you try to avoid turning away people who may be more disposed to the particular show? And on the reader side, do you have any recommendations for reading negative reviews or building a relationship with reviewers to avoid missing out on shows that you like that the reviewer did not? Or do you recommend seeking out reviewers with whom you tend to agree now that we have access to so many different sources? This is a good question. There are lots of different critics. So first off, you know, what's your take about, are you just solely saying this is bad, I didn't like it, or do you try to abstract a little bit and say, who is this for? Who would this work for?
Yeah, I think the hard part in that is when you know, it's actually what I say in my class too. It's the how do you watch Mad Men or watch Fargo and love all that kind of stuff and have these high expectations. And then you turn around and you watch like Gotham or, you know, I like Gotham actually. I jumped on it a bit more this year than last, but, you know, how do you, grading a curve basically for network shows that are trying to reach the broadest audience and can't show nudity and can't swear, that kind of thing. How do you, yeah, you just have to. And you have to say, also, sometimes you have to say, I don't like this show, but boy, does it fit with the show before it and the show after it. And that's why it was created a lot of times.
And what do you think about the other thing? Do you like to read reviews from critics who you think are going to be in line with your taste? Or do you like going the other direction and finding ones where it's a totally different perspective than what you've got?
Well, first of all, one of the things that I always tell people is I never look at anything until I've already seen the show.
Sure.
Right? You don't want to be influenced mm-hmm. in any way, even like subconsciously. And it's weird. I don't like to read reviews so much as I like to read think pieces from people I like. For the initial review, I'm kind of less interested in what anybody else. I mean, honestly, this is going to sound awful. I don't really care what anybody else says. I just don't. That doesn't influence me anyway. I'm perfectly fine being the outlier, whether I like a show or hate a show. And whether somebody else likes it or not doesn't influence me one bit. What I'm looking for, if I enjoy something that they did, is probably because I like their writing. And I can like that even if I don't like their take on it. I will say that I do sometimes get frustrated with critics who who are not friends of mine, who I don't know that well, and you know they write about something and I think that they're missing it. That kind of bugs me, and that's something I don't actually bring up with them because I don't know them. I wouldn't take them online, But like sometimes I'm thinking, wow, you missed out kind of what they were all about, or or you said something that was terrible about the show, which was my favorite part of the show. That kind of bugs me a little bit, but I let it go. No, I tend to I will say that you are right. There are film critics I know, if they hate a show, the person you just mentioned previously, then I'm probably going to like that movie. But now, as far as TV goes, there's four or five writers who, if they do like a big think piece, that's what I'm more interested in reading than a review.
Hmm. Interesting. Okay. We're doing a lot of behind the scenes.
We are.
Stuff.
It's this a little inside baseball.
Super inside baseball episode. Okay, we've got I've got room for three more. So here we go. I'm gonna blast through these. Dean from the 707 says, for like the vast majority of TVTM listeners, I've been inspired by the adventures of Hobo Eric. Therefore, my wife and I plan to spend the whole of 2016 traveling the United States with the goal of visiting a church and a bar in every state. We will have time during our travels to watch some TV, though New York and California provide the lion's share of TV show locations. I was wondering if you could suggest iconic shows we could watch in particular states. You've been talking about Northern Exposure a lot lately, so that's a no-brainer for Alaska, maybe Washington as well, since it was filmed there. Are there any other suggestions? So, come to think of it, with cell phones, my area code will stay in the 707, even though we won't be in the 707. Good point. And this might be a good thing for listeners to send in some iconic TV locations in various states as well. What do you think?
Wow. I mean, there was a time when people always sought out the Cheers bar and then the Seinfeld cafe or restaurant.
Watch some Treme in Louisiana.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Watch some Friday Night Lights in Texas.
Uh-huh. Those are good ones. I don't know. I always think about foreign stuff. So I always think about England when I'm watching stuff. I want to go to, I've never been to England, so I want to go to England.
Oh man.
I know.
I have some friends who are there now who are huge Doctor Who fans, and pretty much everywhere they turn, or Sherlock fans, and everywhere they turn, there's a well, that was in this episode and that was in that episode. And I definitely had that when I went there for all the, like, my first time in England, we went to Yorkshire, and I was doing the All Creatures Great and Small trip basically at that point, because I loved that show when I was a kid. But yeah, this is, people should send them in. When you're in Indiana, you got to watch Parks and Rec. You know, you can. I'm sure somebody can make a map of like the TV shows that are in all the right states for your.
I think people should.
And for Hawaii.
Oh yeah, that's
Magnum PI.
Yeah, that's
not
a good
Hawaii
one.
50. Magnum PI, please.
Yeah, and I there's probably a lot of stuff that I've watched where I want to see. You know, hey, there's Paris, or there's Italy. I want to see those cities, right. Or countries. But one of the subsets to this is. People who send thoughts in on this, maybe include, because here in San Francisco, this is a pet peeve for all of us, stuff where it's like, that's not a thing. That does not connect. That street does not lead there. Hmm. Because, you know, if you're in New York and Los Angeles, those things, like, that doesn't add up. Sometimes they do it on purpose. Like, I'm watching, like I said, The Man in the High Castle, and some things don't add up in San Francisco.
Yeah.
But I think that's supposed to be partly on purpose. I haven't quite figured it out yet. But yeah, it is kind of funny where you watch and like, oh, you know what? That's actually not on that side of the bay.
So speaking of Hobo Eric, here he is. Hobo Eric.
He's in. Yes, he's back.
Currently in the plus 44, coming to a 209 and 415 near you soon.
Wow.
That's exciting. He said, I had no idea I was inspiring millions of listeners. I'd like to inspire them some more by re-recommending The Daily Show. I've been watching every episode since the changeover, and the political humor is just as strong as it ever was, with a slightly more rebellious streak. Trevor sometimes takes a more scathing view and jokes of the U.S. political system than Stewart did in his later years. Take his raucous takedown of the Republican National Committee over The Daily Show's Iowa ban. Can I also implore people to stop posting on Twitter and Facebook items like, oh my, I can't believe that a big thing happened on The Walking Dead last night. It's the same thing as a spoiler, as you watch the episode differently waiting for the thing to happen. They think they're being cute and obtuse, but they're really just making me mad, and you wouldn't like a hobo when he's mad.
You probably wouldn't.
Nope.
Any kind of trouble could happen with an angry hobo.
All right, so check out The Daily Show and do not be cute and coy on Twitter and Facebook about those spoilers.
Yeah. I will say this, though, just quickly about that. And I maybe I'll do a column on it later. I disagree. I'm not feeling the vibe on The Daily Show.
Interesting.
Yeah, not feeling it.
Well, we've got dissenting opinions here. I have to say, I need to check back in with The Daily Show because although I've been recording it, I haven't been watching it. I have been watching basically the comedy portions of Late Show with Stephen Colbert and enjoying those greatly. I actually have. That's basically my kind of half hour's worth of comedy that I used to have as The Daily Show with Jon Stewart is now it's now Colbert. So I've that's why the current Daily Show has sort of fallen off the radar for me. So I have to check back in with that. I'm liking the Colbert stuff though. I think he's doing a great job.
Yeah, me too. Mm-hmm.
And last letter, it's speaking of OG letter writers, it's George D.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
Classic.
The original George D. Says, hey guys, I want to follow up on Matt's question from last week or however long ago, depending on when Jason reads this. It was last week, George. Come on, man.
Wow, George, tough customer.
Do you think college football accounts for some of the differences in America's Saturday night or Saturday viewing habits? At this point, you might spend 6 to 9 hours watching football on a Saturday, at which point you might not want or be able to watch more TV. Patiently waiting for another hootenanny, George D.
Patiently. I like that. There's also somebody who keeps reminding me that I have not yet checked in with the New Parkway about...
Yeah, about a hootenanny, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. You think college football is that powerful enough to change why people don't watch Saturday television?
I think there's more college football available during the, you know, on Saturdays than there used to be. Not just at night, but like throughout the day, because now you've got ESPN and you might have seen like one college football game or maybe two college football games. I would throw this on the pile. I think what I said last week was I think it's a whole bunch of things, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think this is one of them, is that the sports are so readily available and now, you know, they're the counter programming with more Saturday night college football, but there is way more college football during the day. That could be one reason why, you know, I don't know. I think we can't find a clear reason because there isn't one. And it's just a whole bunch of these little reasons, but this, you know, sports, readily available sports, like that you can gorge on sports on the weekend is not something that was around in the like late 70s and early 80s when Saturday TV was at its peak. Maybe that does play a part. I don't know.
Yeah. I have to bow out of that question because I don't watch college sports.
Ah,
look at that.
Yeah. I do watch some college football. Though.
Oh, you
although,
do?
I do.
Yeah.
I do.
Cal.
I got the Cal season tickets, in fact. I do. I enjoy them. And the Pac-12 After Dark is amusing because crazy things happen at night in college football, it turns
it
out.
That's right.
Yeah, all right. Well, so I'm gonna cut it there.
Jam packed.
So many letters too. So we got to get more now because we read so many. So you can tweet us at TVTM. You can tweet me individually, Jay Snell, and Tim Bastard Machine. You can send us email podcast@tvtalkmachine.com, and you can post on the Facebook page like Hobo Eric and his thousands of followers by going to facebook.com/tvtalkmachine, and that's how you can reach us. And,
yes.
And we'll be back next week for number 59.
59. It's kind of shocking.
Yeah, I know.
But people still remember that we had that one week where we didn't connect them. Wow. Harsh crowd.
Why they have to lash out?
Where's the love? Why so much hate?
Indeed. Well, all the love is going to Hobo Eric. Clearly,
clearly.
That's because they don't want him to be angry. Because angry hobos lash out. We've learned a lot today. All right. Thanks to everybody out there for listening. Tim, pleasure as always. See you next week.
Okay.